From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The father is a veteran radio comedian. The son is part of one of today's hippest TV shows, Late Night with David Letterman. Now Bob and Chris Elliott have written a satirical memoir called Daddy's Boy, a son's shocking account of life with a famous father. Bob and Chris Elliott are our guests on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, Jill Kirk-Conway tells us about growing up in the isolation of the Australian bush. Her early schooling was through correspondence courses, but she later became the first woman president of Smith College in the U.S. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reports on the Boston Early Music Festival. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on the way we use human terms to describe machines and vice versa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Bob Elliott has made a career of spoofing radio and television programs with his partner Ray Goulding. Bob and Ray teamed up in 1946 and since then have had comedy shows on radio, TV, and Broadway. Bob's son, Chris Elliott, is carrying on the tradition of mocking the clichés of broadcasting. Chris is a writer on The David Letterman Show, where he's written in a lot of parts for himself. Perhaps you've seen him as the conspiracy guy or the panicky guy. He's also appeared as celebrity guests, doing his impersonations of Marlon Brando, Morton Downey Jr., and Jay Leno. Chris always comes off like an impulsive oddball, whereas his father is always reserved and moderate. Chris plays against his father's low-key image in a new book called Daddy's Boy, a son's shocking account of life with his famous father. It's a satire of all those confessional memoirs by the sons and daughters of celebrities who reveal how their parents secretly abused them. Bob Elliott was allowed to write a rebuttal to each of his son's chapters. Bob and Chris Elliott are my guests today. I asked Chris to elaborate on the concept of his new book.
Well, basically, it's a shocking, explosive account of my life with a famous father, being Bob of the popular comedy team, Bob and Ray, told in frank, often hard-hitting terms, but I think with a certain amount of love and caring from an incredibly bitter son. The unfortunate thing about the book is that for legal reasons, my lawyers were a little concerned that perhaps Daddy here could sue my pants off for some of the things I've said about him in the book, so he gets every other chapter to rebut what I say, which I find rather unfortunate.
Explains a lot about why I'm sitting here and letting him ramble on this way, because I haven't really sat down and read the book. I glanced through his chapters when he wrote them last year, and I understood I was to rebut them, but I saw nothing that was libelous or, well, I really didn't study the material he sent. So I'm embarrassed not to have read it at this late point in the game.
Well, in part for your sake, then, I'm going to ask Chris to read an excerpt.
Yeah, Dad, maybe you haven't heard this part. This is from my chapter...
I'm sure I'd like to.
...called Birthday Hell, in which I describe one of the birthday parties that Daddy was always one to take on and orchestrate. He loved to do that. And this was one where I was not allowed to invite any of my own classmates, as you'll hear. I was always a very shy little boy. I was scared of clowns, and I retreated violently from anything that smacked of audience participation. At a party, if a magician pulled me out of a group as his volunteer assistant, my body would immediately stiffen like a plank of wood, and my scalp would foam up with hot sweat. Anything like a sing-along would elicit the same reaction. I remember needing oxygen at Macy's after meeting Santa Claus, and once I told Ronald McDonald that I wished he was dead. So all in all, I was not a party boy, and no one knew this better than Daddy. Still, my sixth birthday was to be bigger and better than any before. Daddy filled our backyard with every conceivable form of audience participation known to man. Are you enjoying this so far, Dad?
Have you begun it?
There were clowns, mimes, jugglers, puppet shows, magicians, dancers, all eager to involve me in their acts. There were fashion shows, wrestling matches, and Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, gave a cooking demonstration. It was everything that I hated. I was allowed to invite only two of my classmates. The rest of the invitations went out to Daddy's friends. Among those who attended were Dick Cavett, Al Hirschfeld, and Jerry Vale. Not the most exciting group of playmates for a six-year-old kid. Dick Cavett bent my ear for an hour and a half about peanut butter. But for my dad, the party was a big success. As usual, the press was invited, the television networks set up their anchor booths around the yard, and the Happy Elliott Clan public relations machine shifted into high gear. Music filled the backyard. It was Steve Allen hogging the grand piano. Charles Kuralt wrestled Andy Rooney shirtless, and Art Buchwald rode the giant trained pig. At lunch, the big table was set, and I sat at the head of it, and we ate bean and bacon soup and filet mignon, blood rare, as usual. And the photographers snapped their shots of the privileged life of which the world was so envious.
Now, Chris Elliott, what are some of the books that you read to get in the spirit for this malicious tell-all book?
Well, sort of unfortunately...
I'm sure I've interviewed every one of the authors, by the way.
Probably. Well, I guess I went back to see if there were any books like this, and I found that there were quite a few. I guess Christina Crawford's Mommy Dearest was sort of a template for some of the stuff, and of course Gary Crosby's work about it, his dad, and B.D. Hyman's book. There's a little of that in this also. I must say, though, my dad's ignoring my chapters. I find that incredibly bumptious on his part.
Well, Bob, were you ever afraid that people would read this book and not get the joke and think that you were the kind of father as is described in the book? And,
no.
And that you forced Chris to dress like you and put on a bald wig?
Well, I don't know what that means. But
what's chapter that? Three, Dad.
Oh.
You really haven't read the book.
No. I was never concerned because I thought I made my points perfectly clear. It was a chance to... set down some ideas and thoughts I've had over the years and had no place to go with, and this seemed a real good spot.
Chris Elliott, when you were growing up, how aware of you were you of your father's comedy? Did you hear radio shows? The TV show was already over.
Yeah, the TV show was over, and I heard him on the radio. I was aware he was funny, but I assumed everybody else's dad was too, and it never really occurred to me that no one else's dad had a radio show. He'd leave in the morning wearing a suit and a tie and carrying a briefcase. I'd hear his voice on the radio, and then he'd come back in the afternoon, but I never quite made the connection that he was a performer. I guess when I was about 10 and they had a Broadway show, I started to realize that he makes people laugh for a living and that maybe I could try to rip off the public that way also.
Did he do characters around the house?
No. It was a very normal, dull, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
Good word.
Childhood. There weren't, it wasn't like, a wacky, off-the-wall comedic lifestyle that we led. It was very dry-witted.
I think that really was the secret of Bob and Ray not being wacky or off the wall, although some of the material came off that way, but we were very kind of introspective and shy in a certain extent, and when we began radio, we were amusing ourselves.
Well, let me reintroduce you both. My guests are Bob Elliott and Chris Elliott. Bob Elliott has worked for years with Ray Goulding and the comedy team of Bob and Ray, and they've had their own radio and TV shows. And Chris Elliott, you probably know from Late Night with David Letterman, where he has several regular occurring characters, including the conspiracy guy and the panicky guy and the under-the-seats guy. And he's also appeared briefly in Nick and Hillary, was it called?
Very briefly.
Well, as briefly as the show lasted. And together they've written a parody of these confessional books about how children were mistreated by their celebrity parents, and the book is called Daddy's Boy. What I'd like to do is speak with you each individually for a few minutes about your own careers. And Bob Elliott, why don't we start with you?
Okay.
You and Ray Goulding each started off as radio announcers.
Yes.
Before teaming up together. Was this at the same station?
No. We began at different stations in 1940, 41. And I began in Boston and went into the Army in 43 and came out in 46. And that was when Ray first came to the station.
What kind of announcements did you have to do?
Oh, everything. We did news and we did commercials and... And at that particular station, we did fish reports. Their public service at the time, which every station had to have, and theirs was fish reports, was to broadcast the prices at the Boston Fish Pier when the boats came in. You had to do that three times a day.
Did you have an authoritative voice for that?
Oh, yeah. And I knew the boats, and you would say, the Stella B with 14,000 pounds of mackerel and so forth. Well, that's when I first met Ray. It was 1946, and very soon after we fell into the ad lib pattern.
Well, how did you start doing that? How did you start?
Out of boredom, I was doing a record show in the morning, and he was a newsman, and along with the engineer. We were the only three there. So after he did the news, he'd stay in the studio and banter back and forth with me, each day a little bit longer, and then we would invent characters who would come in, voices. We gave them voices and became a whole cast, finally.
I think one of the sketches that you also became best known for, The Slow Talkers of America.
Yeah, well, all of those things developed later. They were ad-lib to begin with, though, but that was a big hit in our Broadway show in '70, and the Komodo Dragon Expert was another.
Would you say something about the speed of The Slow Talkers of America?
If you have time. I am Harlow P. Whitcomb. I am president and recording secretary of the S T O A, the Slow Talkers of America.
What was behind the Slow Talkers of America?
Just somebody that we had interviewed or seen or heard interviewed in the course of our activities as plane announcers, you know. And I'm sure you've met them, too.
Oh, yes. I can assure you I have.
Terrible urge to speed them up, get through this.
I was just watching on video some of the kinescopes from your old TV show, which was on between 1951 and 1953. And you think back to how comparatively primitive things were in the networks at the time
that
you were doing that.
That was what in those days was the network. It was New York and Chicago, I guess, maybe Philadelphia. And then the kinescopes were air freighted to the West Coast. They were a day late being seen out there. But it was fun. There was no pressure, and it was everybody contributed a lot more than they do or can do now. And I think it was more fun. I don't know. Seems to me like it was.
When did you give up the radio show?
The last commercial radio we did was about 1977, was on WOR. And then we did three or four 13-week series for Republic Radio, which mm-hmm. is still heard on and off all the time. Any place I go, somebody says, I heard you last week, you know. So it's still on.
I want to ask you what you think of the late-night TV humor, since you've performed on Saturday Night Live,
mm-hmm.
and your son Chris is on David Letterman all the time. I know that a lot of comedians from who are older now really don't like the late-night shows, and they think that they go too far in their language and in their subject matter. I was wondering what you think.
Well, I don't know. I don't really...
Stay up that late.
No, I stay up. I don't talk to comedians that much. Uh-huh. Nowhere near... I have nowhere near the touch with them that Chris does, because he sees them more often. But I enjoy the late-night comedy. It's changed a lot, but it's today's comedy, and that's fine. That's good.
I want to talk with you each some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guests are Bob Elliott and Chris Elliott, and they've collaborated on a new book called Daddy's Boy, A Son's Shocking Account of Life with a Famous Father. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are Bob and Chris Elliott. Bob is half of the comedy team of Bob and Ray. Chris, his son, is an Emmy Award-winning writer and performer on Late Night with David Letterman. Chris has written A Shocking Account of Life with His Famous Father, but he allowed Bob to write rebuttals to each chapter, and the book is titled Daddy's Boy. Chris, let me talk with you a little bit about your career. Now, you didn't go to college. You just knew that wasn't going to be the direction you were headed in?
No, I didn't have a good time in high school, and I just couldn't see myself in school, and so I didn't go to college. I look back on it, I don't really regret it, because good things happened. Not a lot happened in that four-year interim that I would have been in college, but I think I sort of got a bit of a head start in what I wanted to go into by not going.
Well, you got started as a page, right, at NBC and giving tours of the
facility? Actually as a tour guide for Rockefeller Center, which is kind of different. My dad was a page, but I used to take tours around Rockefeller Center, take them into Radio City Music Hall and up to the observation deck. And, in fact, that's where I first met Dave because I was up there selling tickets to the observation deck, and Dave showed up one day when he had a morning show at NBC before late night, and he showed up with his mother, and I think it was his mother, and the first thing I did was blurt out who my dad was to try to get his attention, and it did, and I talked to him a little bit, and then charged him the kitty fare since he was with his mother, and he went up to the observation deck. That didn't get me my job at late night, but he remembered me when I was hired there. So,
how were you hired?
I had worked at PBS in New York, and there was a writer's strike, and a lot of people that were working in entertainment in at the networks were picking up other jobs, and I met somebody who was friends with the producer of the morning show, and so I, you know, had a sort of an in for an interview. I was hired as a runner.
Now, what were the first jobs you did on the David Letterman show?
Yeah, I was a runner was what I was hired at about $200 a week. And basically, that was just to fetch people coffee and break the Xerox machine and stuff like that. And then I was a PA, production assistant, and in charge of Stupid Petricks, auditioning the people that come on with their parrots and their dogs and cats. I was terrible at that job, so they promoted me to a writer about a year into it.
When you were doing the auditions for Stupid Petricks, were there terrible and embarrassing accidents?
No, actually, not as often as you would think. There were terrible and embarrassing acts that I just...
Did you feel sorry for people who thought that this was actually going to be funny on TV and it was just dreadful?
I guess I sort of felt sorry for them, probably more than I do now, because now it's such a given aspect of late night. I think people actually go out and buy puppies and train them for a year to do something on late night so they can get on the show. And in fact, I had one guy who did that. I remember this is years ago when I was auditioning them that had admitted to me after I had nixed him from these auditions that he had just bought the dog that afternoon and hadn't quite learned how to play the guitar yet. But,
what was the first time you wrote yourself into a sketch?
I wrote myself in only after I was hired as a writer, which was about a year and a half into the show. But other writers had written me into pieces from the start. I was on the first show, actually, when Dave did a tour of the studio, and I ended up at the end. He went into the control room, and there was like an Oktoberfest going on there, so I was in Lederhosen and drinking beer and all that. I guess the first running thing was the conspiracy guy that I sort of developed into my own act.
Would you describe the character?
He's just a paranoid guy who was certain that something was going on that Dave wasn't telling us about on the talk show. Whether it meant, you know, if Dave said that they didn't have time for a specific author or a comedian, the guy would jump up and claim it's a conspiracy, and he'd run out of the studio. And eventually he was, I guess he was usually carried out of the studio. Confusing the panicky guy. The conspiracy guy was carried out of the studio by two goons of late night goons. The panicky guy, who was the outgrowth of the conspiracy guy, was pretty much the same thing, except when he ran out of the studio, he was run over by a floor buffer.
How did you come up with these guys?
The idea basically was that here's Chris Elliott. He's a staff member on Late Night, and he wants desperately to be on TV. So he's going to try any way he can to be on TV. And so if you went on that assumption, it was fairly easy just to come up with really lame little characters to do just to get my face on TV. Eventually, people kind of got behind these characters, though, and sort of expected me to perform. Which they tend to do now.
Well, did you ever want to be a stand-up comic?
No, I had no, I really did not have a calling at all to stand-up comedy. I tried it once, I think when I was about 16. I went to a comedy club and auditioned with a friend of mine. We had an act that we wrote not dissimilar to some Bob and Ray sketch. But it bombed miserably. I think we went on at 3 in the morning, and I remember trying to save the act by doing a quick impersonation of Lee Harvey Oswald. And the MC came on and said, that's the way to do it. Leave them barfing. So I never went back to stand-up comedy after that.
Was it hard for you to get up your confidence to be on stage after that?
I've sort of forgotten about it. So it wasn't hard. It was hard to walk by that comedy club though.
You managed to get an article about yourself in Teen Beat,
mm-hmm.
one of these teen magazines.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if this is the true story, a couple of people in your staff called up and said that.
My manager.
You were a hunk.
Yeah, my manager called up and said that she wanted to package me as, or they, Late Night was trying to package me as a teen idol, and. You know, no one at this teen magazine, I think, was over 13 years old, so they didn't stay up for late night. So they said, sure, bring him in. So they took a photo of me in a goofy wig and with my shirt unbuttoned down to my navel. After that, they had a nice little centerfold there, and I signed it, Love, Chris, and stuff. I got a lot of fan mail, actually, at late night from a lot of, it was odd, it was a lot of letters like, I can't stay up late enough to watch your show because I have school the next day, but you look pretty handsome. Can I get an autograph? And so I think I crushed a lot of pre-teenage girls' hearts with that one.
Well, what'd you think of how you looked with this wig and with your shirt unbuttoned?
Oh, pretty good, but as you can see, I have a full head of hair anyway, so I don't really need to wear it.
You do a lot of impressions on Letterman, but they're, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Self-referential.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's always sort of, it's still the same joke, I think, with me. It's still, people know, okay, here's Chris trying another angle, and other people do impersonations, so he's going to try them. Occasionally, I'll hit one that is actually okay or passable. People seem to like the Jay Leno that I did.
Thought that was
pretty accurate. But even that, I just called myself Chris. It's kind of a safety net. The impersonations don't have to be too good because I can still get laughs out of the fact that I'm bad.
Chris Elliott is my guest. And by the way, he's written a new book called Daddy's Boy, A Son's Shocking Account of Life with a Famous Father. Which I should say is a funny book.
People are having that reaction.
Right. I don't want people to think this is a genuine expose here. You did a very funny cable. Was this Cable? I think it was Cable.
Yeah.
An FDR
right.
one-man show parody.
Uh-huh.
That was basically a parody of all the one-man shows on Teddy Roosevelt
right.
and FDR and all the Hal Holbrook, Mark Twain
Will
type
Rogers,
shows.
Yeah.
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 Do you really hate these one-man shows?
I do.
These very actorly one-man shows?
I think I am just drawn to them incredibly. Since I was a kid, I was. And I really don't know why. I saw Hal Holbrook do Mark Twain, and he does him wonderfully. But I've always found some bit of it disdainful and perfect area for my sense of humor to parody.
Well, you always know it's going to happen in a way. There's going to be a flashback where suddenly
yeah.
the kid is 10 and he's afraid and
right.
he's yelling for his mommy, mommy.
Yeah, it's the talking to the imaginary people that I find really kind of embarrassing.
And there's these sudden shifts between laughter and tears.
Right. Well, it's also you get to the point where, you know, some of these shows are just badly written and it gets to the point where they talk about themselves after they're supposedly dead. You know? It's just like, then I died and 100 people showed up at the funeral and how would they know that?
But you want to act. I mean, not to do one-man shows, but you want to get into acting.
I'm not comfortable with theatrics. Or theater. I do want to perform, but I think it'll always have that sort of edge to it that maybe is not the most mainstream. You know, I'm not sure I'm going to be an actor per se. I think I'll probably end up in the books as a humorist.
Well, that means that it will be hard for you to be cast in other people's movies.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, although I can see myself doing that easier than I can see myself writing a movie for somebody else completely. You know, I think I'll eventually continue just writing for myself and doing stuff that I write and occasionally doing stuff that other people write.
What's your arrangement on The Letterman Show now?
I'm on a performance contract. I stopped writing full-time about almost a year ago, I guess. So that I could do outside projects, and look what it's gotten me. So I don't know. I'm in there about 3 days out of the week or so, and I write myself in, and then get the hell out of there as fast as I can.
Now, what are the times that you both have appeared on camera together?
Well, it was a memorable role I did in his FDR special, And I played the makeup man, and I was also in the other one.
Action Family.
Action Family.
Yeah, yeah. You had a.
I was the hot dog man.
We had a fight sequence that we did together, in that.
Right. Well, you buy a Frankfurter from your father, and it has perfect line of mustard on it, and then you yell at him, you wanted ketchup.
Right, I had asked for ketchup, and so it turns into this perfect Quinn Martin fight sequence from Mannix, and we used a bad double instead of my dad for most of the action, and I think there's even one shot where the double actually just looks at the camera, and it accidentally was not edited out.
Now, how does that make you feel that your son writes a scene for you, and what's the scene? Him attacking you.
Well, it's pretty much, I guess, what he's done here in the book.
That's a really cogent point.
Yeah, it seems to follow in everything he does.
How did the process of writing this book together change your relationship at all?
No, I don't think it changed the relationship any, really. We maintained a remote relationship while we're writing it, and we're leaving separately from here.
Yeah, it's the book tour that's changing it. We're really
just being together is really terrible.
We're kind of just sick of each other, and it's just begun.
Bob Elliott, I just want to ask you something. You know, you have a reputation for being very funny, and you know, having written all these very funny sketches over the years. You also have a reputation for not being very talkative in public.
I'm not.
Why is it? Because you always think that somebody who's a comic writer and performer would have this gift.
Well, I know. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just not liking to talk about what I do. If I were an insurance man, I probably would talk about insurance all the time. Most of them do. But to me, really, our whole careers have been doing what we enjoyed. And it made people, got to people, and once we were off the air, we were within ourselves. I think that sums it up.
Chris, do you think there's any connection between the work you do now and the kind of comedy your father's done over the years?
I think there's a definite connection with the earlier stuff that my dad and Ray did. You mentioned his 1952 television show. I just recently, a couple of years ago, looked at those tapes of that show. I had never seen them up until a couple of years ago, and I realized that back then, when he was about my age, I guess, if the jokes weren't the same as what I'm doing now, the attack on the idea was sort of the same. There was a lot of self-referential stuff, a lot of double reality stuff, you know, breaking the reality of a sketch, etc. And that to me is very similar to what I've done for almost 8 years on Late Night, and have thought for almost 8 years that I sort of came up with on my own. And I realized that I'm just have been ripping off my dad, and I think that show is different than what people generally now think of Bob and Ray as two guys in suits, you know, sitting doing sort of an interview parody type thing that they later became known for.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us a little bit about your lives and about the new book. Thanks.
Oh, thank
Thanks a lot
you.
For being
thank
here.
Thank you, Terry.
My guests have been Bob Elliott and Chris Elliott. And Bob Elliott is best known for his work with Ray Goulding and the team of Bob and Ray, the comedy team that's been on radio and TV. And Chris Elliott is a regular character on Late Night with David Letterman. And Chris has written a new book called Daddy's Boy, a kind of a fake expose about a son's shocking account of life with a famous father. And it has rebuttals in it by his father, Bob Elliott. And it's just been published by Delacorte Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a small child on a desolate Australian ranch, Jill Kerr Conway began her education through correspondence courses. Years later, she became the first woman president of Smith College. Coming up, Jill Kerr Conway talks about growing up with the macho code of the Australian bush, then becoming a feminist. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays us some of the musical highlights from the Boston Early Music Festival. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg shows us how the words we use blur the distinctions between man and machine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The White House announced today that the U.S. government has chartered planes to help evacuate Americans from China. The State Department has ordered all family members of U.S. diplomats and non-essential embassy staff out of that country. Michael Richards has details.
Two chartered jumbo jets are scheduled to arrive in Beijing tomorrow. One of them will also make a stop in Shanghai on its way out of the country. The announcement came after Chinese troops fired on the diplomatic compound in Beijing where many Americans live. No one was hurt. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the American ambassador in Beijing delivered a vigorous protest to Chinese officials over the incident. The administration has been criticized for not acting more quickly to evacuate Americans. Other governments have been evacuating their citizens for a couple of days already. At the White House today, Fitzwater said the administration has done everything possible to help Americans leave the country. Fitzwater also said the U.S. did not know how decisions are being made in China right now or where the leaders are who are making them, although he did say there is clearly a functioning government structure in place. The president is expected to comment on the situation in China at a presidential news conference scheduled for tomorrow evening. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
Crowds gathered throughout the day at large intersections in Beijing, defying martial law to vent their anger at troops who suppressed pro-democracy protests, killing hundreds of people. News of the bloody weekend assault has fueled anti-government activities in other Chinese cities as well. More from the BBC's William Horsley.
Peking, overrun as it is by troops and tanks, is now virtually the only political center in China where major anti-government demonstrations are not going on. In Shanghai, much of the city has been turned into an official no-go area by protesters using barricades. In Canton, a crowd of workers occupying a public square were reported to have been dispersed by police. In the ancient capital of Xi'an, a radio broadcast said the city's life had been paralyzed by disturbances and that if they were not ended, the consequences would be unimaginable. The regional protests have grown more intense as word has spread around the country about the horror of the slaughter in Peking last weekend. But as in Peking, the authorities seem to be preparing to crush the protests by force.
William Horsley in Beijing. The author of a Republican memo attacking House Speaker Tom Foley resigned today. Mark Gooden stepped down as communications director of the Republican National Committee following cries of outrage from both Republicans and Democrats. Democrats criticized the sexual innuendo contained in the memo entitled Tom Foley Out of the Liberal Closet, which compares Foley's record to that of Liberal Democrat Barney Frank, an acknowledged homosexual. Republican Committee Chairman Lee Atwater today apologized to Foley. Republican Congressman Bob Walker says the apology, along with Gooden's resignation, should put an end to the matter.
Sounds to me as though Lee thought that a mistake was made at the Republican Committee and is attempting to correct that mistake. I think that's probably a positive sign that we are trying to be responsible about this.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says President Bush was disgusted by the GOP memo. Pakistan Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, today asked the U.S. Congress to continue support for the Afghan rebels. During an address to a joint session of Congress, Bhutto said the Soviet Union is sending new weapons to the Kabul government, and therefore the rebels will need support. The prime minister also asked for continued U.S. help for her fledgling democracy in Pakistan, and Bhutto reiterated her pledge that Pakistan will not build nuclear weapons. She said her country is willing to accept nuclear non-proliferation safeguards for South Asia. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 16 points to close at 2512.32, 213 million shares traded hands. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Boston has become one of the world's early music capitals. Since 1981, the city has hosted a biennial international festival of early music. This year's just ended on Sunday, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, who lives in Boston, was there.
Every other year, the Boston Early Music Festival brings together performers, scholars, instrument makers, publishers, record distributors, and early music fans from all over the world for a week of concerts, conferences, classes, and, of course, controversy. At the exhibition, you can try out a viola da gamba made in Paris or a Celtic harp made in Cuesta, New Mexico. And you can check your pitch on an electronic testing device from Calgary, Canada. You can visit the great historic instrument collection at the Museum of Fine Arts or attend a demonstration of Scottish lowland bagpiping. An air of happy competition prevails as rival crumhorn makers compare notes. But most people come to hear music, and there are concerts in halls, churches, and hotel rooms going on till midnight, some of them by some of the greatest musicians in the world. Two English early music superstar conductors appeared this year. Andrew Parrott, the founder of the Taverner Choir, led a fascinating reconstruction of a Monteverdi Mass celebrating the end of the plague in Venice in 1631. No separate score for this Mass exists, but scholars believe that most of the music is in an anthology of Monteverdi vocal music called Selva Morale e Spirituale that was published 10 years later. Contemporary reports say the Mass included some purely instrumental passages, but no purely instrumental music by Monteverdi survives, so appropriate selections by other composers are used instead. Nothing as richly textured or as moving as Monteverdi himself, though. The main event of the Boston Early Music Festival was a concert performance of Mozart's early operatic masterpiece, Idomeneo, led by Roger Norrington. It's probably the least well-known of Mozart's greatest operas. The story is a kind of postscript to the Trojan War. Mozart took an outmoded and stilted form, the so-called opera seria, or serious opera, humanized its stock heroic figures, and revitalized its rigid conventions by sometimes allowing one number to flow directly into the next. There are magnificent arias and choruses, marches, and even a ballet, and some of Mozart's most sublime instrumental writing. The greatest moment is probably the quartet. Maybe for the first time in opera, four different characters express their individual, conflicting emotions simultaneously. The singers here are four superlative young Americans, Jeffrey Thomas as Idomeneo, the King of Crete, Lorraine Hunt as his son, Idamante, and Jean Omerle and Lisa Saffer as the two rival princesses, Ilia, the captive Trojan, and Electra, the exiled Greek, who are both in love with Idamante.
Thank you.
not every early music event at the festival was state of the art. This year's object lesson was an enthusiastic but provincial group from Germany who put on an old-fashioned, heavily cut version of an opera called Enrico Leoni by the obscure Italian-born German composer Agostino Steffani. He was an important precursor of Handel. This group would benefit from attending a few more early music festivals.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Special thanks to WGBH Radio in Boston for providing us with live recordings of the festival. This is Fresh Air. Jill Kerr-Conway grew up on a sheep station in New South Wales, Australia. In 1960, when she was 25, she left Australia for graduate school in the United States. Conway became a feminist historian and the first woman president of Smith College in Massachusetts, one of the largest women's colleges in the world. Conway recounts her childhood and the years leading up to her departure for the U.S. in her memoir, The Road from Corrine. Corrine was the name of her father's ranch, established on 30,000 acres of grassland. I wanted to have a sense of the place where Conway was from, so I asked her if she would describe the landscape.
Oh, yes, with pleasure. If you look at a map of Australia and draw a line 500 miles due west of Sydney, you come to an area that is just empty. If it's a map that shows climate, it will show less than 10 inches annual rainfall. It is totally devoid of trees, except where there's a submerged stream that produces a few straggly clumps of trees, absolutely flat, very beautiful in colors, wonderful scarlet soil, and usually grass that is burnt to a beautiful gold and silver color by the heat of the sun, and an enormous sky.
So you grew up in a very isolated setting.
Totally. Our next door neighbors were about 50 miles away on one side about 20 miles another and 10 or 12 in another direction.
Your first schooling was through a correspondence course.
Yes, it was. My mother thought I could do two years in one, and she told the correspondence school that, but they thought there were two children on the place, so they sent the first lesson of the first grade and the first lesson of the second grade. And continued in installments all the way through the year. It wasn't clear to me that it was work of a different degree of difficulty, so we didn't know until the end of the year.
I love what you say about studying alone in isolation, that you were introduced to study as a leisure time activity. It sounds like you never really grew to dislike education in the way that so many children who go to schools do.
Well, I think that's true. You know, so much time is taken in school with getting children to sit down at the same time or stand up at the same time or concentrate on the same thing. And for me, it was sheer pleasure. I was doing hard physical labor on the sheep station, and I worked at that 4 days a week. And on the fifth day, on Friday, I got to sit down and do my school, and it was such a treat because I'd be given my own pot of tea, and my Friday was a baking day, so there would be great smells of fresh baked scones and cookies coming from the kitchen, and I felt totally indulged, and I've never felt about learning any other way.
Were you sure that you would go to college?
It was very clear in my family, because my mother was such a feminist, that I would. And interestingly, the stereotypes of gender worked in my favor in my family, because it was expected that my brothers would probably not go to university, and would, since our father was a rancher, that they would take up life on the land too, and that meant that they would begin that right after school.
You went to the University of Sydney first, yes?
Yes, I did.
And then you thought about what to do next. You decided you didn't want to go to school in England because you'd feel like a colonial there. You applied to Harvard and started living in the United States. Did you find that there were more opportunities for women?
Oh, goodness, yes. Well, I arrived at the Harvard Graduate School. I lived in the graduate residence where there were several hundred other women all getting PhDs and all enormously bright and interesting people drawn from all over the world. And I quickly encountered a set of strong and powerful women's institutions in this country, which simply didn't exist in the Australia of my day. And I found a director of my graduate studies who regularly told his students that the contribution of women to American intellectual life was as important as men's, and handed out lists of women whose lives needed to be studied and whose intellectual histories needed to be written and so forth. That was just a new world for me.
What set you in the direction of being a college administrator, first a vice president at the University of Toronto, then the first woman president at Smith?
Well, I was a woman who had the good fortune, I think, to be born at the right time. I was just finished my PhD and beginning life as a professional historian just at the point when there was an enormous expansion of higher education in the United States and Canada. And I went to Canada with my husband, who was taking part in planning and building a new university in Toronto. And myself joined the history department at the University of Toronto. And in the process, I suddenly discovered one day that although I had joined the history department at the University of Toronto with a group of young men, all trained in American doctoral programs like me, I was the only one who wasn't being promoted, and I found that I was also being quite severely discriminated against in my salary. And so I just got in a rage and went and confronted the department chairman and the dean with this information. And they very quickly rectified the situation. But when I was finished, I realized that there were loads of other women faculty who had parents or children to support and were in much more jeopardy protesting such things than I. So I began organizing the women faculty. And before I knew it, I was in a leadership role that I just stumbled into. And very shortly thereafter, there was a change in the university administration, and I sort of had to put up or shut up, and so I accepted a position as one of the university vice presidents. And so I sort of backed into it and then found out I really loved it.
Mm-hmm. You spent 10 years as the president of Smith College.
Yes.
The first woman president of Smith College, which is
right.
A women's school. Now that women are admitted to top colleges around the country, do you think that there still is a need for women's colleges?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, you have to remember that women's colleges in this country are probably the only ones that have a consistent record of having co-educational faculties. They usually have roughly 50-50, and most of the institutions that are co-educational in their student bodies have a long way to go in terms of equal recruitment of women faculty and administrators. One learns to take one's place as an intellect and a politically active person in a society in which all the roles of leadership are open to women. And once you learn that and internalize it, you're never phased again.
Did you ever go through days where you'd think to yourself, how did I end up the president of a college? After all, I started in this correspondence school.
Often, I must say, I think that I was very fortunate in that early education because it gave me a very strong sense that I could educate myself and learn any task that I set out on. And so I wasn't fazed by all the new skills I had to learn at different stages in life. But certainly, I was often amused by that.
When was the last time you returned to Karain, the area where you grew up in?
I took my husband there about 4 years ago. He was absolutely overwhelmed by the isolation and the emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
The house where I grew up is now empty. The ranch is part of a much larger property. So that it was both very lovely to see that landscape again, and very poignant to see this world my parents had built, now in process of decay.
In the process of decay?
Yes, because the house isn't lived in any longer, and the garden, which I describe in my book, is gone. But as I also say, the land renews itself and is as beautiful as ever.
Well, I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your life. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Jill Kerr-Conway resigned from the presidency of Smith College after 10 years. She now teaches part-time at MIT and writes feminist history. Her new memoir, The Road from Karain, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what stories are coming out of China today?
More foreigners are moving out of China all the time, Terry. We'll have a story on that. We'll have a report from Shanghai as the unrest spreads from Beijing into the rest of the country. We will have a long report from Richard Gonzalez, who is back from Peru and has a great deal to tell us about production of cocaine in the Huallaga Valley of Peru. A new treaty will be signed tomorrow between the United States and the USSR defining the rules of engagement. Gorbachev today talked about the Russian military budget and what the Soviet Union spent on the war in Afghanistan, how they plan to pay for reform.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Living in the technological age has created new stresses and strains in our lives. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explores how we coax and curse the machines in our lives.
A lot of people get up in arms about the way computer language has been appropriated to talk about ordinary human activities. Granted, you hear a lot of this, and some of it's sublimely silly. Let me have your input on this. We've got to get out there and interface with our customers, or the face is familiar, but I can't access the name. But this is an old story. Every new technology has given people a model for talking about themselves. Think of how much of our ordinary psychological language is based on electricity. He's a live wire, I tuned it out, we're on the same wavelength, she's blown a fuse. And in the same way, Freud and his contemporaries borrowed words like repression and ambivalence from hydraulics and chemistry. After all, we are machines, among other things, and a lot of what we do lends itself to a mechanical understanding. But the people who worry that all this sort of talk is somehow dehumanizing might take some comfort in listening to the way programmers talk about the systems they design. I'm not talking about the hardware so much as about the code that inhabits the computer in something like the way a human spirit inhabits its own more fragile housing, the arrangement that a philosopher once described as the beast in the machine. These systems are so complex, and their behavior is sometimes so erratic, that it sometimes seems as if the only way to describe them is in human terms. I hear this talk all the time from the coven of computer scientists I work with, particularly when I ask one of them to help me when my own machine is refusing to cooperate. The system will refuse to log me out, for example, and I'll call over Dr. Lamping from across the hall, and he'll stroke his chin and furrow his eyebrows like a child psychologist contemplating a refractory toddler. And then he'll say something like, "Oh, you've confused the poor thing. It thinks you're still logged on to another machine." Or I'll run into Becky in the hall and she'll say, "You better save your work often. The network is acting flaky today. I think it's stressed." When these folks are talking about a badly designed program, they'll say it's demented, or in the extreme case, brain damaged. In that case, you have to be careful because it may send the machine into a state of complete non-responsiveness that's referred to as catatonia. Of course, humanity has been personifying its artifacts since the earliest cave person lashed a stick to a stone and called the resulting configuration Old Betsy. That's why sailors in less enlightened ages called their vessels she, and why people still say that their cars are temperamental or ornery. But that way of talking implies only that the car or boat has some kind of primitive anima, not that it has a full-blown mind. No matter how my car is acting up, I'm not inclined to think of it as stupid or crazy. That kind of talk I reserve for my friends, my family, and my workstation. Still, there's one common thread in the way we talk about cars and the way we talk about computers. In general, we only anthropomorphize a machine when it's behaving badly. You hear cars described as temperamental, but not as even-tempered. And in general, programmers don't describe systems as clever or sane when they're doing their jobs quickly and efficiently. Why should we attribute a human soul to machines only when they frustrate and exasperate us? Probably because that is the only way that we can have our revenge on them. To paraphrase John Donne, we endow machines with souls so that the devil can do them mischief, and so that we can thus damn them to hell.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, inside a Turkish harem with writer Alev Lytle Crutier. Crutier's great-aunt and grandmother both lived in a harem, and their recollections of that life led Crutier to write her new book, Harem, The World Behind the Veil. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Flowers in the Dirt, the new album from Paul McCartney. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest adventure of the crew of the Starship Enterprise, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Linda Martin and Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.